From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Do I see a darkness to Valentine's Day? No. I think Valentine's Day is fun. Because it is, it's an incredibly commercial holiday, I like to have fun with it.
That's one of our favorite chocolatiers, Valerie Gordon. If you go to one of her shops in L.A., don't expect to find run-of-the-mill heart-shaped chocolates and bonbons of old.
We do the classic heart chocolate stuff, but then I just like to get a little creative with it. I really like to choose a theme. Coming upon Valentine's Day this year, I thought, let's go pinup girl. Let's go kind of naughty black satin blush 1950s pinup girl. So that's the theme of our collection this year. And so it's not pink, it's blush. And there's a little bit of, you know, flirty, naughty fun involved.
Broken hearts, black
broken
hearts.
Yes. The way I described it more was two halves make a whole. So it's sort of a graphic exploration of hearts, not to sound too obnoxious, but that's what it is, where it's half blush, half black, and they match up.
So I wanted to talk to you about this huge trend that's going on for quite a while now of the type of art that is put on top of chocolates.
So those are called chocolate transfers. When we launched our company in 2004, which was so long ago, we had no transfers on our chocolates. And my whole thing was really about, I want to see the chocolate. And as we've evolved, I've embraced the transfer. And we are doing all of our design in-house, actually, which is really fun. I think that the duality of it, the image and the taste and the experience, people have fun with it.
Is it like you have a design software and you just design it with a template and then what gets filled in for inks are chocolate?
It works like silkscreen or an iron-on. We develop the design in-house and then we actually send it to a third party who creates these sheets of chocolate transfers that is laid onto tempered chocolate. And then you chill it, and when you remove the plastic, the image that is in cocoa butter stays on the chocolate.
Oh, it's like old-fashioned stencils.
It is. It's really fun.
That's very, very interesting. And you have this really interesting collaboration where you call them chocolate tiles, and they kind of harken back to almost an early California kind of tile exploration.
Yes, that was the first collaboration that we did with Commune Design, and it was inspired by Byzantine tile. And there's 49 teeny pieces of chocolate within a box, and you get this wonderful pattern that's sort of mesmerizing.
And also, if you eat chocolate obsessively, it encourages you to go on to the next piece.
Totally.
Because I like have this strange reading habit. I've been reading like a 1920s crime novel.
Mm-hmm.
It has one of those characters who likes to sit in bed and eat bonbons.
I love it.
And I have to say that when you read about people enjoying chocolates in that single-minded way where you know they're not multitasking, they don't have a phone by their bed, they don't have a screen in front of them, they're actually sitting in a room that's probably silent, eating chocolates out of a box. It seems like the most pleasurable, indulgent thing you could give yourself.
And refreshing. Doesn't silence sound refreshing right now as we talk? But I agree. And there is such a romanticism around chocolate. And it's that multi-sensory exploration that comes into play that is deeply, deeply satisfying. I agree. I think that a box of chocolates is best enjoyed with full attention. Of tasting, looking, smelling, seeing, you know, a good bonbon that generally costs a lot of money now, right? Generally, they're about $3 a piece for a good bonbon. That's not nothing for, you know, a few grams of joy. So you want to take a minute with it, bite into it, accept the exterior, accept the interior, and really sort of let the story of the bonbon evolve.
How do you go about creating a new confection, a new flavor? What inspires you? What do you look for to bring visual and flavor together?
I look at a variety of inspirations, and it might be a feeling. It might be a color. Like the blush color is the thing that really inspired the Valentine collection. The Christmas collection that we just did had a lot of bold graphics, really big bows. There's always a layer of nostalgia in everything that I do. I always look back as I look forward. Like, Christmas was all about the 1960s gift wrap station in a department store. That was the full experience of the Christmas chocolate collection. I really am very motivated by a happy moment that's created through chocolate and through dessert.
It's interesting that what you went to answer that question were all visual statements of packaging. So how do you take that visual sense and move it into flavor? Like, what is blush as a flavor?
For instance, there's the Valentine's bar that is happening this year. The exterior packaging is reminiscent of a Valentine card, and you can write a to and a from on it, which is sort of cheeky and cute. And the bar is itself filled with blush flavors. So rose petal, dehydrated raspberry, juxtaposed against 61% chocolate. To me, it's the full experience of it.
Let me just jump in here and say 61% chocolate. Mm-hmm. That would please me.
Yes.
I tend more to the milk side.
Yes. But 61% isn't astringent. It's not that super aggressive, hyper bittersweet flavor. And the great thing about 61% is it tastes like chocolate, which a lot of chocolate doesn't anymore. It's become almost a little bit too analytical, if you will. And I want chocolate to taste like chocolate.
And
I want
it to have that melting point in my mouth.
Yes.
I don't want it to be something I have to chew.
No, you don't want to fight for it. You don't want to fight for the joy of it. Maybe the packaging is built around the broken hearts. Those are all about the flavor and the texture in that chocolate, because I really wanted to sort of see the inside of a bonbon, because there's always these layered surprises when you bite into a bonbon. And I started this series of doing exposed bonbons. So it's darkened milk chocolate with caramel and caramelized toasted rice. And there's a little bit of soy salt in there. So there's all these different textures, and it's sort of popping out of this beautiful molded piece of chocolate, which is, it's a little alarming visually, which is fun.
Wow. Because, you know, so many of us are fascinated by quantity. I know you must be ramping up like crazy this time of year. How much chocolate do you make leading up to the holiday?
A lot. We always get to a point every Valentine's Day and every Christmas where we are literally unmolding chocolates, hand-dipping chocolates. Another body is standing there putting it directly into a candy cup, directly into a box, and out it goes in UPS or to customers.
You become Lucy on
it
the...
It becomes, yes.
Lucy on the assembly line.
Just the ultimate manic panic. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of chocolate, which is great. It's great. And it's so satisfying to know that that box of chocolate is going into someone's hand and it's going to create this special moment in their day. It's wonderful.
That's Valerie Gordon. Find a link to Valerie's confections on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. While we're on the subject of Valentine's Day, did you ever wonder how sound transforms the taste of a piece of chocolate when you pop it into your mouth? Deliciousness is an experience that we think is centered in our noses and on our tongues, but it's actually influenced by so much more. Here's Good Food contributor Simran Sethi. This segment is interactive, so make sure you've got a bar of chocolate close at hand.
I'd like to take you on a little aural exploration. If you're not driving or walking, go ahead and close your eyes and listen. What do you see? An icy soda? A bowl of chips? Is your mouth starting to water? Probably. That's because sound influences everything, from our breathing and heart rate to expectations about smell and taste. Have you ever heard a sitar playing in your local Indian restaurant? It's designed to make your samosas and vindaloo taste more authentic, says flavor researcher Charles Spence. Sound, he writes in the study Eating with Our Ears, is the forgotten flavor sense. Our sensory experience of food can change up to 60%, depending on what we hear while eating and drinking. Throbbing music in a club leads us to down more alcohol at a faster rate, while the din of an airplane dulls our perceptions of sweetness and increases awareness of savory tastes. That's where that hankering for Bloody Mary mix comes from. What we hear as we chew and slurp, or when we tear open a package or twist a bottle, builds our expectations and influences what we ultimately taste. But it doesn't stop there. Sound also impacts our perceptions of texture. In the latest issue of the academic journal Appetite, sound engineer Felipe Carvalho, along with Charles Spence and others, explores this cross-sensory connection.
I am a Brazilian with a touch of Ecuadorian, so I'm Latin American, and I am doing research in Belgium. So I'm doing a PhD in two universities in Belgium. I work as an engineer in the Free University of Brussels and as an experimental psychologist in the University of Leuven.
Felipe has spent his academic career looking at the influences of sound through what he says was most readily available to him in Belgium. That would be beer and chocolate.
Well, it was kind of a coincidence. It was not something that came from a scientific question.
But the depth of smells and tastes in chocolate and beer are perfectly suited to these studies.
It's actually quite strange to think that sound may have a significant influence on the way we perceive tastes and flavors. We don't have this the opportunity to actually reshape the entire tasting experience. But with our research, what we are showing and what we would like to bring awareness is that sound can have an influence. And this influence can be, in some aspects, very significant. It can actually add a lot of value to the tasting experience.
I mean, it's incredible. We think of flavor as being fixed, but it's not.
Yeah, I also find it interesting because it's not obvious. Actually, the starting point of this research comes from the fact that the sensory information is processed by the brain altogether. So we can actually use the information from one sense to influence the perception of the other sense.
That cross-sensory exploration comes together in their latest study, appropriately called Smooth Operator. All right, listeners, get your chocolate ready. What Felipe and his team found is that the taste of chocolate changes depending on the spectrum of music we're listening to.
Yes, somehow, indeed. This is what we have proved in our experiments. What we do is that in our experiments, people, for example, they taste the same chocolate twice without knowing that they're in fact tasting the same chocolate. And each time, the only thing that changes in their experience is the sound.
Let's put this to the test. You're listening to the Bitter soundtrack. Are you tasting anything different?
I would say that bitterness in the experiments that we have done so far, and also looking into the scientific literature of my colleagues that also have worked in the same path, we see that bitterness is usually related to lower frequency ranges, to the dissonance, to more complex harmonics composition of instruments, for example, metal family of instruments like trumpets, trombones.
And sweet music is transposed to the other end of the spectrum.
Sweet music, it would be the opposite, exactly. So sweet music would be much more related to higher pitch types of sounds, more consonant harmonics, types of instruments that can be understood perhaps as more pure in terms of harmonic composition, such as pianos and flutes, lots of echo, lots of reverberation, and so on.
Bitter and sweet soundtracks have been developed before. But the musical influence the Smooth Operator researchers created next is unprecedented.
We have decided to move forward and to break this taste barrier and go more into the assessment of flavor attributes. We have shown that sound is also able to change the way you perceive the texture of chocolate.
It's the first ever soundtrack that makes the chocolate in your mouth seem creamier.
Creamy, well, creamy soundtrack is very flute. I can imagine a flute with a very major type of interpretation with a lot of reverberation, major chords with a lot of reverberation, and very slow speed, I would say.
This is the new frontier of flavor.
Yes, yes, definitely.
There you have it. The flavor of chocolate and other foods is, well, malleable. Go make it your own. For Good Food, this is Simran Sethi.
You can listen to the sweet, bitter, and creamy soundtracks that Felipe Carvalho and his team created on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. While you're there, check out Simran's new podcast. It's called The Slow Melt, and it's all about chocolate. Next, let's find out what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. It is time for the Market Report. Let's see what Laura Avery's shopping for this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking right now with David King, who's the owner and beverage director of a restaurant in downtown LA in the Little Tokyo district called Baldoria. David, your title at Baldoria, other than owner, is beverage director. That means you are the cocktail dude.
Yes,
and you're here looking for awesome ingredients. So tell us what you're finding.
So right now we've been looking around for citrus. We're working on a cocktail right now called The King, which is an inspiration not of my last name, but actually of Arnold Palmer. So we've got the Masters coming up, and I wanted to do a take on an Arnold Palmer, which is obviously going to be tea and lemonade, but we're doing a little tweak. So instead of doing tea, we're actually doing Darjeeling tea infused vodka, and I'm looking for a citrus to pair to make my lemonade substitute with it right now.
When you say lemonade substitute, so you mean for the sweet sugary lemonade everybody's familiar with?
Exactly. I'd like to look for something that's a little bit more floral because I want something that's going to play with the aromatics of the Darjeeling tea, which is going to pop out from the vodka, because you're not going to taste too much of the tea. It'll just be slight tannin once we do our infusion process.
Okay, and are you doing the vodka tea infusion in-house yourself?
In-house. We do all of our infusions under a pressurized, it's actually an ISI whipper. The easiest way for me to do tea infusions without getting too much tannin is to do them very, very quickly, under pressure, super high pressure, and that way you take out all of that astringency that comes out from any teas or other things. It's a much easier way to do infusions. It's also a really great way to make bitters at your home.
Wow. Okay, so now over to the this magic citrus fruit you found. What is it?
So this is going to be Marrakesh limoneta. It's the first time I've ever actually seen this or heard of this. It's apparently from Morocco. It is amazingly floral and actually finishes with a almost like an anise type note to it, which is really amazing because I think that's going to pair with some of the earthier tones that come out with Darjeeling. And so I'd love to make a juice out of it. And it's actually a really, really bright, I like to call it a very poignant acidity, where sometimes acidity sort of lingers and it takes over the whole palate. This is a very, very direct acidity, which I think will work well in this cocktail.
Yeah, there's the acidity that just basically hurts your teeth. And then there's this that like has a flavor to it.
Exactly. Yeah, this one has a flavor, finishes, and the finishing note of this, as I was saying, is anise, and you don't get just blindingly, oh my God, that's Pucker Warhead.
Right.
Which is not what we're looking for.
Right, and can you do anything with the rinds and the skins too?
Oh yeah, so one of the things, whenever we juice any of our produce, the best thing to do, rather than just getting the juice, is to also squeeze the rinds, because you want those oils in the juice as well. So you're getting all of it. We don't just want part of it because a lot of the aromatics are found in the oils and in the skin of the rind of whatever citrus it is. Best way to juice anything, always hand press. Always do it by hand.
You mean that old school thing with the lever that comes down, with
yes,
that dome
man.
That comes down? Really?
Oh yeah, of course. Like if you're gonna do it right, I mean, it's not like we're squeezing that much and you squeeze them every day. So you might as well, you know, do it the right way.
Okay. And you're able to do that at the restaurant with all the, everything you do, you can still do that.
Oh yeah. By hand. That's a very important thing.
One squeezer?
One squeezer, namely being me. So that's, you know, bar prep is actually one of those therapeutic things that if you're lucky enough to do it as a restaurant owner, I advise you do it.
Okay, bar prep meaning just getting all your little ingredients, your jars of herbs, all that stuff, your vases full of goodies all laid out?
Yeah, so get all of your herbs laid out, cut all of your garnishes, which means cut all of your citruses, squeeze all of your juices for the day, get everything set up so you have your mise en place set. And that's, it's a kind of a systematic way. And it also is nice in the same sense that you're getting a walk around the farmer's market. It releases all of those smells and sort of gets your creative mind going instead of worrying about whatever numbers or taxes or employee costs or whatever you are going to have to worry about later in the day.
Okay, great. Well, so great to hear about that. And I'm glad you made a new discovery here at the market. That's kind of what we're all about. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
That was David King. He is the owner and beverage director at Baldoria, and he is up here at the farmer's market getting inspired and creating a new cocktail for all of us to enjoy. We're talking now with Margarita Smith. She is the farmer who grows those Marrakesh limonettas here, sells them here at the Wednesday Farmer's Market. You have the most amazing citrus program on your farm. Tell us how many varieties of citrus you grow.
With citrus alone, it's probably over about 300 varieties of just, you know, tangerines. We grow about 50 varieties. Oranges, well over 15 to 20. Grapefruit, it's another 20. Yeah, tons of stuff. Amazing fruit. And it is all part with UC Riverside Citrus Extension.
So, for example, this Marrakesh Limonada that David is working with at his place, how did that wind up on your farm?
Originally started in Morocco, but then UC Riverside got a hold of it. I think Florida might have gotten to allow it to come into the States first. And then it came to California, and we got to do one of those samples. We have about six trees of those that we've been growing for the past 8 years.
Do you foresee a need where you're going to need to plant more if you can, like, increase the demand for them?
I think so, eventually, because the French know it as a bergamot. So technically it's the French bergamot. It's not the true English bergamot, just with the flavors and the kind of like super floral anise flavor and the zest and juice. So that's getting more popular, especially down here in Santa Monica, where chefs and bartenders all the time are like, do you have bergamot? Do you have bergamot? It's like, no, I'm out of those, but I have this. And it blows their mind away because it's more depth than a regular English bergamot. Mm-hmm. The trees are still growing, so it's just trying to figure out the average yield of one and how big the market is going to be. Yeah, so we might not.
You know, we've had 5 years of drought, and now it's raining. Has the production of the trees been impacted by the drought?
Definitely. Depending where we planted them, if it was more clay-based soil, you know, that like no water is getting deep into the roots. So they've been struggling a little bit. But this past winter, you can see they're all really like thriving and still have life in them and are finally gonna produce a whole lot, which is awesome.
So this winter has been good to Mud Creek Ranch, and you're feeling pretty happy now with the water supply. How are your wells?
Our wells are super great right now. We actually have a very rare agreement where we can pump water out of a creek that flows all year round. So water crisis for us, we never get hit that hard. We definitely pay for it still, paying for the water, but we're never gonna run out of water. Paying the bills have been really nice the past winter.
All right. Well, your stand, not only your citrus fruit, you got, you know, avocados and cherimoyas and other things. So your stand is always so much fun to stop by and visit.
Yeah, it's always fun to have people too and tell them about all the neat varieties and then just growing awesome product that people love and appreciate.
Yeah, but you have a term. It's beyond neat. What is it?
Super rad.
Super rad.
Everything is super rad at Mud Creek Ranch.
All right, Margarita, well, you and your mom are here every week, and we really appreciate what you do, and Steve back on the farm. So thanks a lot for bringing us all this delicious fruit.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Laura. Thanks.
That was Margarita Smith. She is the daughter of Steve and Robin Smith, who own Mud Creek Ranch. And you can ask Margarita anything you want to know about citrus fruit grown at Mud Creek Ranch, and she will give you some great information. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a minute, we travel to Asheville, North Carolina, to hear about the similarities between Spanish cuisine and food you'll traditionally find in the American South. Don't go anywhere.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. The god of modern cuisine, Ferran Adrià, hails from Spain, and his protégés have opened acclaimed restaurants around the globe. José Andrés has roots in the States, with successful restaurants on both coasts, and yet Spanish food still hasn't broken through in the way that other global cuisines have. Katie Button has set out to prove that Spanish cuisine is more than mere tapas at her Asheville, North Carolina restaurant Curate, also the name of her new cookbook. You were raised in South Carolina. What are the similarities between Southern food and Spanish cuisine?
One of the big things is the use of pork and the love of pork. The Spanish brought the pigs to the U.S., so that's understandable why we have that connection. And then how we cook with those ingredients, like in collard greens and using, ham hock and salt pork in order to flavor their vegetable dishes. It's the same in Spain.
And what about the use of vinegar to spike up savory foods? That's similar too, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they use it traditionally in Spain. They're using a lot of sherry vinegar is the vinegar that you'll find most frequently, and they use it to bring brightness to their dishes. I think it's, to offset some of those richer, deeper, fattier kind of flavors.
Famously, you worked in the pastry department of El Bulli. You were one of the most successful stagiaires. How did your background in chemical and biomolecular engineering help you sort of find your bearings quickly in his kitchen?
I was surprised at how much it helped me because I worked in labs and came from a degree where I used a scale frequently. I was just following like laboratory procedures. When I went into his kitchen, his recipes were written like laboratory procedures. And they used food, but they were very precise and everything was detailed out, sometimes all the way to the 10th or 100th of a gram. And so I felt really comfortable in that environment, following those recipes like I would, some sort of science experiment.
I understand that you were there during the famous incidents where you had to polish rocks.
Yes, that I look back on it and the technique that he used for the stagiaires that came in, it was pretty ingenious because he'd bring in 50 new cooks and they were coming from all over the world and they had different levels of experience and background. Some of them were executive chefs, chef de cuisines of their own restaurants, and they were showing up. And day one, we were out in the garden removing all of the rocks, polishing them, and putting them back in place. And it was like, wait, we shouldn't be doing this. I'm a chef. I'm a cook. Why am I out here in the garden doing yard work, But it made everybody get past that. It was like, no, we're all a part of this restaurant and its success. Down to the very details of how that rock garden looks falls on all of our shoulders, and we all have to take responsibility for it. So I think it weeded out the people who were going to succeed and those who might have needed a little bit of help right away.
I find that when I start to learn how to make a new cuisine, I find that the physical moves that happen with a similar group of ingredients over and over again are the key. So what are the go-to moves with the go-to ingredients in the Spanish kitchen?
One is olive oil and then sliced garlic. And the go-to move there is browning your garlic. I think, often we're really afraid of taking garlic so far that it burns and gets bitter. In Spain, they take it pretty far, like right to that very edge in order to get that flavor. And then they're ready to go with a backup ingredient to cut the cooking, like sherry wine or onion or whatever that next ingredient is. You just keep building flavor that way. And usually you'll add the next ingredient, like onions, and you'll cook that down till it's glassy and starts to brown. And then add your tomato or tomato paste. And again, reduce that all the way down till it caramelizes. And so you're building flavor upon flavor upon flavor. And those are the go-to moves I've seen in Spanish cooking.
As an Italian chef myself, one of the things that I find so fascinating about Spanish food is the same use of really fresh, basically simple vegetable-based ingredients, But then with Spanish cooking, there is this addition of a whole level of spice that lends a much more complex set of flavors than happens in Italian cuisine. Could you talk a little bit about how you build that more complex kind of flavor?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, when I think about Spain and the influence of spice on the country, you know, I think about where it's located and its orientation north of Africa. And so it gets a lot of its influence in spices and the cuisine that came from North Africa. And you see that in their dishes, like the grilled lamb skewers that are marinated with a whole bunch of Moorish type spices that bring out this kind of richness in the lamb that then, you know, you cut with some acidic, simple vegetable component like pickled cucumbers, for example. And then pimentón, you know, that's the big one that people think of, the smoked Spanish paprika. And they use that, I mean, to finish a lot of dishes in Spain. It just adds a depth. I've started putting it in at the end of something that I'm cooking, soups or vegetables or braised greens, just a little touch at the end. It adds a little smoky richness without making it spicy per se.
Now, pimentón comes in a few different profiles. There's the spicy, the sweet, and then this bittersweet in the middle. Do you tend to have a favorite that you think is the perfect amount of nuance for you?
I tend to use actually the smoked sweet, and then I tend to add heat with other ingredients like ground cayenne pepper. You know, it's a little easier than having all three in my pantry. So I go with that smoked sweet, probably because I love that heavy hit of smoke flavor that it can add to dishes.
The food of the country is so regional. Are dishes of one area more of a jumping off point for those home cooks that are just getting familiar with the cuisine?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say because you're right. The cuisine in Spain is so diverse. My jumping off point has been Barcelona and Catalonia, that region, because I've spent most of my time there. My husband's from Catalonia and his family. San Sebastian would be another good possibility. They have this wonderful culture of montaditos and pinchos. They're these little bites on bread, and you really can't go wrong. They're a great appetizer. You put whatever you have in your pantry or your fridge on a piece of toast, and all of a sudden, it's this amazing gourmet snack.
I don't think we can have a conversation about food in Spain without talking about paella. What do you consider to be the most important ingredient of that dish?
The sofrito, which is the vegetables that you are cooking down and caramelizing and browning before you add your subsequent ingredients. I used to say stock, but traditionally paella in Valencia and other areas is made with water, and you kind of like create your stock in your pan. However, you can't go wrong by adding even more flavor with an absolutely wonderful, delicious, flavorful stock.
And part of that sofrito has to be the olive oil, right?
Yes. I mean, the olive oil is important. And then I like to use garlic and onion and tomato. Lots of people will also throw in peppers, like bell peppers, a mix. And the key, though, is cooking at each step when you add that next ingredient. It's taking the time to cook that down until it's evenly caramelized before you add your next ingredient.
You have to take the time.
Yes.
So you claim that your mother-in-law makes the best fried egg ever. Describe it for us.
It is the best fried egg ever. I think if anybody else would have it, they would agree. So it's called huevos con puntilla, which are eggs with lace. And I can't imagine a better way to describe an egg dish than to add the term lace as a descriptor. What she does is she takes a pan of olive oil and she heats it up till it's pretty hot, just about smoking, because olive oil is a lower temperature oil, so it'll start to smoke a little earlier, so around 400 degrees or something like that. And she gets it up that hot, and she puts in a fair amount of olive oil, like half inch to a full inch, and cracks the egg into a bowl and then slides it straight into the piping hot olive oil. And what happens is the egg immediately blisters up on all the edges, pops and crackles and blisters, and you toss oil over the top. You baste the egg with that olive oil, and it turns a little crispy and brown all along the edges that end up looking like lace. And you pull it out almost as soon as you've dropped it in the oil. It takes, I don't know, 10 seconds, maybe 20, depending on your oil temperature, and you pull it out and it's ready to eat, and it's the perfect set white with a super runny yolk.
Yum. So talk to me just a little bit about gin and tonic. It's one of my favorite drinks, and I know Fran Adria played with it a lot.
I love a gin and tonic. It's the perfect combination of refreshing, a little bit sweet, that tart citrus, and then the bitter notes from the tonic water that you're using. And I just think it makes the perfect aperitif or digestif at the beginning of the meal or the end of the meal. My husband is extremely particular about how he prepares a gin and tonic. And he taught me. I was making shameful gin and tonics before meeting him. But basically, you take your ice, and the key is using lemon peel, not a wedge of lemon. You just use your peeler and you peel a piece of the skin of the citrus off that peel, and you rub it all along the rim of the glass and then stick it inside your glass and mix it around with the gin and the tonic. And the aromatics released from just the peel of the lemon are a much better complement for the gin and tonic than actual lemon juice or a wedge of lemon. That has changed my life, that and a good tonic water.
That's Katie Button. She and her husband, Felix Miana, are the team behind Curate in Asheville, North Carolina. Now we travel from North Carolina to Kentucky to talk about mashing up Southern ingredients with Korean flavors. In Louisville, our supervising producer, Abby Fentress Swanson, sat down with Chef Edward Lee at his restaurant, 610 Magnolia. He also owns Milkwood downtown.
How would you describe your cuisine?
I don't know. That's always been a difficult question. I cook Southern food, and I am very much influenced by my native cooking, which is Korean, but also the cuisines of Asia, which I find to be endlessly interesting. So I never try to pigeonhole it, because at 610 Magnolia, we just do anything and everything that sort of surrounds us. I think part of what I see in modern cooking, in American cooking, is this idea of getting away from sort of the elevator pitch of who you are as a chef. My food is like my story on a plate. So I cook the influences of whatever I've had my entire life. So, you know, I spent 6 months in France, so it's inevitable that some of that creeps in, although I'm not by any means, you know, a Francophile, and I don't cook French food, but it creeps in there, you know. So you know, my wife is German, and I love German food, and we go out to eat at German restaurants all the time. So that creeps in there. So I never want to be an exclusionary chef where I say, well, because I do this, I'm never going to have sauerkraut on my menu. Like, that just doesn't work for me.
At your restaurant, Milkwood, you have bourbon, pulled pork, bibimbap, kimchi and collards, and shumai deviled eggs. I'm wondering how you decide what works.
Yeah, a lot of it is experimentation, obviously. A lot of it's trial and error. A lot of it's just sitting around and thinking about the histories of these foods and how they come and what form they come in and how they arose out of history. You know, you take the collards and kimchi, for example, right? So I always say, like, collards arose out of a necessity. It was basically a poverty food that arose because you had to take this basically inedible, tasteless vegetable and make it flavorful to feed a lot of people economically. And that was the beauty of collards. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, that really reminds me of how cabbage came to be in Korea. When post-war, you had nothing to eat. You had rice and you had cabbage. And so you had to fight for a way to make cabbage delicious so that you could fill your belly and feel somewhat good about yourself at the end of a meal, because it's all you were eating, maybe some dried fish. The two just made sense philosophically for me. And I thought, well, why don't we put the two together and see what happens? And lo and behold, it's delicious. So sometimes it happens that way. You know, sometimes it happens from a more intellectual place. And sometimes, honestly, it happens by accident. Like the shumai, I was just like, well, I like deviled eggs, but, you know, it's too much. I like the yolk more than the white part of it. And what can we do? And you just start riffing. And you say, we, you know, like Shumai, you know, little different wrappers. And so those things happen. They all happen for different reasons. One thing we never do is kind of force it. For everything you see on the menu, there's probably 5 or 6 things that didn't make it on the menu, like coconut grits. And, you know, we do that and we're like, it just doesn't work. There's something about it that seems really forced. You know, what I do is I really cook from the heart and I really cook from a place of, you know, meaning. And I never want it to be kitschy or campy or forced. And I always say, like, I'm not changing Southern food. I'm just adding another layer of vocabulary on top of what's already there and what's already respected. And so we just kind of change it up a little bit.
Talk to me a little bit more about that, about Southern food and how you've seen it change even since you've been here in Louisville.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in Louisville 14 years now, and you know, Louisville 14 years ago was not a Southern city in terms of its culinary identity, and now you can't, you know, throw a stone without hitting a fried chicken shack. So it's
chow chows on every menu.
Chow chow, biscuits, I mean, you name it. I don't know. It's a good thing. Listen, everything comes in cycles and pendulum swings, and we're seeing this revival, if you will, of Southern food. I love it. I love Southern food. You know, I've always said I'm not a Southern food chef. I guess in some ways I've helped to influence that, but I remember 14 years ago using, you know, local sorghum. None of my guests knew what sorghum was. And I'm like, it's growing in your backyard for generations. And, you know, we were the first to sort of like take bourbon barrels and smoke them and use them in different applications. So we did all that. But we never, I don't think I've ever served a plate of shrimp and grits in any of my restaurants, at least not in the traditional way. So it's been an interesting thing for my evolution, because we just keep pushing and doing what we do. And then all around us is this like huge Southern food revival, not just in Louisville, but in the country. And I mean, globally, you can go to like Korea and there's like Southern food. There's like a barbecue restaurant in Korea that's doing really well. There is this global sort of recognition for Southern food. So it's fun to see.
Some chefs I talk to say there are pluses and minuses to this, because now diners think Southern food is only biscuits and gravy, fried chicken, and barbecue.
And I think the biggest mission for me with Southern food is to always espouse that the South, the American South, is an incredibly vast region. Right, you're talking about Florida Panhandle to Arkansas to Kentucky to the Carolina coast. That's massive. That's you know. So you can't say that this entire vast span of land has one cuisine, and they don't have one culture, and they don't even have one language. My mission is always to sort of identify regional. You're not going to get the same food in the Delta as you are going to get in the Carolina coast, as you are going to get in Appalachia or even, you know, Western Kentucky. So those things, I think, are really important. In terms of everything else, what you see is basically a caricature of Southern food, but you always had, right? There was always the red and white checkered tablecloth restaurant in New York serving fried chicken or barbecue. And there always will be. Just like if you leave Japan, there's fake sushi restaurants all over the world. And there's a couple that are very serious. But for the most part, they're all just mimicking, you know, what they think sushi is. And I think that's just what you're seeing. Like, whether it's Chicago or L.A. or Miami, you're seeing, you know, people doing what they think the customers will embrace as Southern food. Listen, if you're in Miami and you want a fried chicken fix, maybe that's not the worst thing in the world. So I don't necessarily see it as a bad thing. I think there will always be restaurants that ride on the coattails of Southern food because it's such a strong culture, because it's so identifiable, because it has so many iconic dishes. I don't have a problem with it as much. Do I eat there? Probably not. You know, if you're going to a market that doesn't have a history, and it's not in your blood, and it's not in your DNA, and it's not in your physical, you know, viscera to understand and eat Southern food every day. If you're only going to eat it once a month, then yeah, you're probably going to go and eat the greatest hits. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
You recently wrote an article for Cured magazine about fermentation. What kind of fermenting are you doing here at the restaurant?
So we're constantly fermenting things in the kitchen. We've got some miso that we're making out of black-eyed peas. We always do a lot of our own vinegars. So we've got some persimmon vinegar. We ferment chilies for our hot sauce, and that's a long fermentation time. And so we're actually about to release our own hot sauce, which we've had for, 2 years now, but we've never sold it outside of the restaurant. But it's gotten to sort of a tipping point where people are starting to threaten us if we don't sell it. So we're like working on design labels for it right now, actually. So that's fun. We have a greenhouse. It's been fun to really sort of take a lot of the byproduct of the greenhouse and do fermentation work on it, whether it's like tomato leaves or you know, stems and things, and create different flavors. Like obviously, winter is a bleak season out here in Kentucky. I think people always think that Kentucky's warm all the time because we're in the south, but we're actually closer to the Midwest. But yeah, we also have some fun things that we're doing with chocolate, where we're sort of double fermenting some chocolate and seeing how that turns out. I don't know if, you know, we haven't had any results yet. It's like raising a kid, and you hope they turn out to be responsible teenagers, but you never know. They're like in the incubation period right now. We finished up a really wonderful fermentation documentary that we shot in the spring, and we hope to have it out there in March of 17. So
much is fermented, you know, beer, chocolate, wine, bread.
Yeah. And part of the documentary, and I hope you get to see it, is just that we start off with a lot of just very rudimentary ingredients that people don't think about when they think about fermentation. Bread, cheese, beer, kimchi. The world would not be what we think it is without fermentation. I mean, think about coffee. Think about chocolate, vanilla. We, as I think in America especially, don't quite really understand what to do with it yet. It's still kind of like a funky thing. It's a weird thing. I think America especially went through such a industrial process with their food that we still have this remnant of sanitation or cleanliness that has to do with food. So your food has to come from a place of cleanliness, but almost to the point of being not alive. And I think other cultures that are much, much older are okay with funk and dirt, this commune with nature. And I think what we're seeing right now is this really beautiful revolution in America where we're starting to go, okay, let's throw a little funk in there. It's okay to wash something with your hands or to knead things with your hands. And it's okay that we pick up some of the bacteria from the air and the water from your tap water faucet. Like, these things are okay. They actually create fermented flavors. They're all around us anyway. I think you're going to see in America in the next 10 to 20 years, like, that is going to be the big focus. Like, we are going to be okay with, you know, curing something in pots and leaving them out on the counter at room temperature. And it's not going to be like this poisonous thing that we have to throw away. Leaving your eggs out on the counter at room temperature, it's okay, you're not going to die. And these things are all traditions that, you know, in older cultures, it's just the way it is.
What's old is new again.
Always, always. And I think that's one of the things that we you know, at 610, we're so obsessive about the new and innovation and trending cultures and, you know, have cool plates that we plate food on. But the reality is that every time we take a step forward, we have to take one step backwards and look back as well. And for as many, you know, modern gadgets that we may have in the kitchen, we have an equal number of vintage cookbooks. You know, we never want to be the hyper-modernist restaurant, but we're also not like a throwback restaurant. We're somewhere in between. And I think that, to me, I've always loved that middle gap where we try and connect the two versus choosing sides.
I have to ask, because we are in bourbon country, what's your favorite bourbon?
That's like asking if you which child of yours you love the most. That's a really unfair question. My rote answer is always my favorite bourbon is the one in my hand, which is usually the case. I will say it's an interesting thing, because bourbon is, by its definition, has to follow some very strict legal rules, right? So it has to be aged 4 years, has to be in charred new oak barrels, has to be 51% corn. To me, there really is no such thing as a bad bourbon. You have your favorites, and I love Jefferson's Reserve. I love Angel's Envy. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Pappy. The Willett brands are great. There's a new one called Rabbit Hole that's just killer. They're all great. To say one's a favorite, I think if you live in the state of Kentucky, it's hard to say, because you have so many to choose from, and my favorite changes like every other night, all right? Because there's just such an abundance here. And so no, I'm not going to give you a straight answer on that.
I like the ones that you listed. We have had a lot of those in the past 48 hours.
You know, the bourbon revolution, if you will, is adding so much depth to what we're seeing in Kentucky right now, just the cuisine, the chefs, and it's a really fun thing to watch. 14 years ago when I arrived in Louisville, Kentucky, bourbon was not really on the radar. It was just starting to sort of crop up on a couple of bars in New York, you know, and Chicago. It wasn't really on the radar. And you know, 14 years seems like a long time, but it goes by quickly. And to see this absolute, like, shooting to the moon of bourbon and Kentucky and all things Southern, and it's a remarkable thing to just kind of sit here in this one location, which I've been doing for a long time, and look out and see the world change right around you. So to me, bourbon is not just about the drink inside the glass. It's about culture, history, and its textures and stories, and these old guys who you know, weave tall tales and yarns and smoke cigars. And so when you come here, it's about all that, you know. It's about being in Kentucky. So I think there's a huge future in it, where people are going to come not just to drink the bourbon, but to experience, yeah, the food and people, and just bring home some of that to wherever they come from. So we're really excited about that part.
Learn more about the food Chef Edward Lee is fermenting on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we return to our neck of the woods to hear where our favorite food critic is dining. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
It's becoming more and more of sort of a fire-focused restaurant.
That's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold talking about Chef Brian Dunsmore's restaurant, Hatchet Hall, in Culver City.
If you sneak into the kitchen, you'll see like almost walls of flames. It looks like the place where primitive man would have a barbecue.
And we've had his food before.
We've had his food here a lot on the show. His ex-partner, Chris Tominaga, has had a lot of restaurants that we've talked about. And then there's this one. I must admit I was late to doing this, because every time I did a restaurant from either Dunsmore or Tominaga, it would change in like 2 months. But he seems to be there for the long haul.
Is there a biscuit on the menu? I feel like wherever he goes, he brings a biscuit with him.
Yeah, he's famous for his biscuits. But here he has Benny yeast rolls instead, which are nice, fluffy, sort of crisp on the outside, sprinkled with sesame seeds. There's, I think, some kind of primordial difference between Benny and sesame, but you probably have to be in the Southern Food Alliance to have a lot of opinions about it. They're excellent rolls, and they're served with sort of unusual amount of butter. He has a cornbread that's also enormous, with cheese and chilies and also a huge amount of butter.
This could be a dangerous place to go.
It is. I like going there and ordering just a ton of vegetables, because the vegetables are all pretty good. I mean, not just the usual stuff, but slabs of Belgian endive with tons of blue cheese and bacon, Brussels sprouts with pecans. And the dish that weirdly is my favorite there, which is buttered cabbage.
What is this thing with the cabbage?
Everybody's doing cabbage now.
It's so weird.
A meal I had there a couple of months ago with a bunch of friends, and we ordered almost everything on the menu, and the table was just covered with stuff, you know, the roast carrots, the turnips with ham hock, the beef fat roasted potatoes, and the cabbage just sort of sat there in a corner. I mean, I may have had a leaf. Somebody else may have had a leaf. I ended up taking almost all of it home. This place is like an amazing place for producing leftovers, by the way. I mean, I've never managed to get out of there without like a double armload of stuff we didn't quite get to. The next day, I decided to heat them up to go with dinner. And the cabbage became like totally my life's obsession.
I love that. Is he using some kind of meat broth to braise it in and then just using a sick amount of butter?
I'm not sure there's meat broth involved. There is an astonishing amount of butter. And when you see it cold coming out of the fridge, you almost like gasp. But then you heat it up and it's a vegetable, so it's healthy again. And fried shrimp heads are another like surprise favorite. You know, when you go to a Chinese restaurant and you get like salt and pepper shrimp and everybody sort of munches a body and they push the shrimp heads into the middle and the one person who really likes them sits there and crunches them down like potato chips. This is for that one person. There's a chopstick, like a steak tartare, that's topped with fried oysters. And it's a dish that I could swear that I've seen in a cookbook somewhere, but I looked kind of a lot for it and I didn't see it.
It sounds like a James Beard recipe.
I thought it was James Beard. I mean, I looked in like 5 or 6 different James Beard books. But again, I think the restaurant is going more and more grill-oriented. And you get the feeling that he's going away from the idea of everything being shared plates and into having, you know, sort of giant, large format proteins that everybody at the table can have. So there's like an enormous steak, a couple of pounds, you know, simply grilled over fire, but it's a good one. There's a lamb porterhouse that, again, is enormous and comes with a salsa verde that's sort of pushed out with, you know, a lot of parsley, a lot of mint.
This sounds like the kind of place you could go back to at least once a month.
You probably could. And the people who are customers there seem as if they own their tables, like they've never left. There's also a tavern attached to it. They like to call the Old Man Bar.
Which is the best name.
Isn't it the best name?
It's the best name.
But it means that the cocktails are going to be good too. And there's always, if you're into natural wines, I mean just super funky natural wines, there's always stuff there you haven't had before. I think the thing that surprised me most was a Pet Nat, a sort of sparkling wine from Beachy, which is they're winemaker in Tecate, of all places.
Wow. I didn't expect that word to come out of your mouth.
I mean, they've done some good stuff. I mean, I like some of their wines. They're always super funky. But this one is like sort of the best beer you've ever had. But it's wine and it's limited. And I considered myself lucky to get even the taste.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is dining at Hatchet Hall this week in Culver City. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine, Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And thanks to KCRW's Independent Producer Project for helping us bring you that audio essay on eating with your ears. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.